This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. As a chapter ends in the war in Afghanistan, eyes in Washington have turned once again to Iraq. Before September 11th, there was an uneasy consensus on a policy of containment. But now the Bush administration is raising the pressure, hinting that Saddam Hussein could provide biological, chemical, even nuclear weapons to Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network. Yesterday, President Bush warned Saddam Hussein that if he did not admit UN weapons inspectors into Iraq, he would face consequences. Patrick Clawson is director for research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's also editor of Iraq Strategy Review, Options for U.S. Policy. Good evening, Patrick Clawson.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Why suddenly do we have this intensely renewed focus on Iraq?
Well, as you put it so well, the events of September 11th showed us that we can have horrible surprises. And Saddam is the guy who's got these biological weapons that he's been holding on to in spite of UN resolutions which say that he's got to give them up. So that's the general reason. The specific reason why this week is that on Friday, the UN Security Council has to review the oil for food program, and that's an opportunity to discuss whether or not to tighten the sanctions on Iraq and to increase the pressure on Iraq to let arms control inspectors back in the country.
So do you take President Bush's words and those of others in the administration this week as real threats of potential military intervention, or is this just a kind of a political ratcheting up of pressure on Saddam and on UN Security Council members?
Well, it's both. In fact, there's a number of these Security Council members who have been more eager than the United States to raise the issue about arms control inspections. For the last couple of years, the U.S. hasn't been very enthusiastic about the arms control inspections because we thought that they weren't producing very much. And people like the French and the British and others have been encouraging us to put more emphasis on those inspections. And we're listening to them and we're saying, hey, you know what? You got a point. We think those inspections have got to resume. And so let's pressure Saddam to do that.
But European allies have been far less enthusiastic about the idea of military intervention. That seems to be on the table now. When President Bush says if Saddam doesn't comply, he'll find out what the consequences might be, what does he mean? What are the options? What's the range?
Well, there are a lot of options that are short of sending in 500,000 troops. And it's that sending in 500,000 troops, which the Europeans have been saying, hey, look, we don't want to do that. But if you start talking about taking some specific actions to tighten the pressure on Saddam, well, then you might find there's more sympathy for that. To give you an example, Saddam has, in the last year, started exporting a lot of oil to Syria against the sanctions and earning a lot of money that he's using for various nefarious purposes. And if the United States took military action to close that pipeline, I think there'd be a lot of people in Europe who'd say, okay, that makes some sense.
So that's pure economic pressure.
But military force being used to impose that economic pressure.
I see. So sending in perhaps a force to cut off the pipeline.
Yeah, the good Lord invented cruise missiles for a reason.
So that's a step shy of troops into Baghdad.
Absolutely. And there's many other steps the U.S. could do if it wanted to pressure Saddam. For instance, the northern 20% of Iraq has been, for the last 10 years, in the hands of these Kurdish opposition groups. And those opposition groups would like to have better security guarantees from the United States so that they can be more secure that Saddam doesn't attack them. And we might provide those groups with, let's say, anti-tank weapons, something they've wanted for a long time.
And if we did that, what might they be able to do themselves?
If we did that, they've suggested that they would be then willing to have the opposition radio stations, for instance, that would broadcast news to all of Iraq. We in the United States, we support a radio-free Iraq, but it's located right now in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and it only reaches the people of Iraq through shortwave. That radio station could move to northern Iraq if the Kurdish opposition was more secure that they weren't going to be attacked by Saddam's tanks.
Mm-hmm. And what about the balance of thinking on this within the administration? We heard early on about folks under the wing of Donald Rumsfeld who were more hawkish and eager to go into Iraq, and Secretary of State Colin Powell reportedly less eager, more eager in smart sanctions. Is there a consensus that's greater than in the past on a tough approach to Baghdad?
Well, the two sides, as you characterize them, have very different perspectives on what to do, but they've been trying to find a common ground, that is to say, are there things that we can do that will press Saddam that are short of the kind of vigorous action that some of the administration called for in the past? And it's precisely that discussion about what are some measures that we could take that are more limited than Mr. Rumsfeld might want, but more vigorous than Mr. Powell might want, that has led to the kind of comments that you saw Mr. Bush making yesterday, saying arms control, well, there's an issue on which there's broad international consensus, makes some sense. Let's think about pressing Saddam harder on that issue.
But if you look at the dots that are being connected now, it would appear that the goal, the only way to reach the goal that's kind of being suggested might be military, and that goal being that Saddam must go, that Saddam Hussein's regime must go. This is connecting the dots, saying Saddam Hussein could supply international terrorists, fingerprint-free almost, with biological or nuclear weapons. Therefore, this is no longer a tolerable threat, and he has to be shut down. Is that leading Washington to the conclusion that it's got to be the complete removal of Saddam Hussein's regime?
Not necessarily. We're offering Saddam the same deal that we offered the Taliban, which is to say you can get out of the terrorist business, you can get out of the business, Mr. Saddam, of weapons of mass destruction. That's what the UN has ordered you to do. If you do that, then we may well go back to containment. We may not like you, but we'll go back to the policy of containment. We won't try to actively overthrow you. But if you won't give up your weapons of mass destruction, if you won't comply with your obligations under those UN Security Council resolutions, well, then we want to leave the door open for, in fact, taking vigorous action to overthrow you. So we're offering him a deal, saying, look, you live up to your UN obligations, and then we'll be prepared to live with you even though we don't like you. You don't live up to those UN obligations, better watch out.
Patrick Klussen, you've watched Saddam Hussein for a long time. Do you realistically believe that he's going to be willing to give up these weapons that he's gone to such extraordinary lengths to develop and to keep hidden from U.S. inspectors and the world? Is he likely to do that now? And if he's not, doesn't that make something serious inevitable almost now?
Look, he's not likely to give them up, but there's a possibility he will. He may look at what happened in Afghanistan. He may look at how the world's changed after September 11th and say, whoops, better step back here a bit. Now, I don't think that's likely, but we're offering him the opportunity. We're saying to him, we're saying to the leader of Iraq, and not just to him, look, you got a chance. You can save your skins if you do this. If he doesn't, well, he's got to be prepared for the price that he's going to have to pay. But we're offering him a deal.
A lot of chips on the table.
Absolutely.
Patrick Klussen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Klussen is Director for Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. President Bush now says that fighting the war on terror is not just about going after countries that harbor terrorists. It's also about going after the countries that make the weapons of terror. What should the U.S. do or not do to press Iraq for accountability? And how serious a threat does America's old enemy, Saddam Hussein, pose today? For the sake of global security, is it time to overthrow Saddam? You can join our conversation this evening at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from London is Professor Kanan Makia, Professor of Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. He's an Iraqi dissident and the author of Republic of Fear, The Politics of Modern Iraq. Good evening, Professor Makia.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack. Jack Beatty, are you there?
Hello, Tom.
Oh, there you are, coming in loud and clear. Welcome, Jack, and welcome, Professor Makia. We're looking at Iraq and the very stern language coming out of Washington, especially this week. We just heard from Patrick Klussen some of the reasons having to do with UN Security Council considerations of sanctions, that language is being ratcheted up. But the new logic that's being applied here seems to suggest that the Bush administration may well be on track to do something serious. Kanan Makia, take us inside Iraq for a minute and help us see it from the Iraqi vantage. What's the situation inside Iraq today? Do you see any chance that Saddam Hussein is going to fold his tent and say, all right, you win, I'm giving up my weapons of mass destruction, and I will no longer be a threat in the region or globally?
None whatsoever. It's really very simple. We've known the answer to that question for a very long time. No amount of pressure will get Saddam Hussein out of the terrorism business, to paraphrase your last speaker, building of weapons of mass destruction business. Very simply, he sees these, for whatever reason, perhaps not always very rational ones at that, he sees these as his ultimate security. And he has done so for a very long time now, almost 15 years. He developed these. He's been developing these weapons in earnest since the mid-1970s. He used them against his own population for a reason. He's deeply convinced, inwardly convinced, that this, his survival, rests on the development of these kinds of weapons. You have to understand that his army, even during the years of the Iraq-Iran war, when these were tested, I'm talking about poison gases of different kinds, were tested against the Iranians. Again, look at the kind of military problem he was facing so that you get some sense of the psychology of the man. He faced a revolutionary army, essentially. That's what the Iranian army represented in the early years, right out of the Iranian Revolution. Mass human waves was the sort of description of most military analysts. Mm-hmm. As against an army very highly equipped, very technological, but an army whose soldiery could never be relied upon.
That is, his own Iraqi
army. His own soldiers could never quite be relied upon. So he relied on weapons instead, artillery, planes, long-distance artillery, all sorts of. And ultimately, he always had special units whose job it was to shoot deserters. That is how fear was the regulating weapon. This is a very different army construction, say, compared to the Iranian side. But it wasn't working. The war went very badly for Iraq. What tilted the balance was all of a sudden this new weapon developed in Iraqi military-industrial complexes, which when you threw it on the other side, dissolved people's insides over weeks and days. Mm. A terrifying new kind of weapon. You could not die in a blaze of glory across a field, you know, with your machine gun by your side.
This was a chemical weapon, I assume.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that truly changed the outcome of the Iraq-Iran war. It ended up in what Iraq viewed as a victory and what Iran viewed as a standoff, as some military analysts will call it, for a victory for Iraq. And, of course, that war was won also with the help of the West.
A lot of these weapons were also found at the front in the Gulf War, but they were not used as far as we know. How close did we come to seeing Saddam Hussein having them used against U.S. troops a decade ago?
Well, the experts who've been in there and who were inspecting these weapons have discovered them on warheads. So they were actually installed in warheads. But we know that none of those warheads were fired. Whatever it was, held him back from using those particular weapons. It is said that the United States warned in no uncertain terms that the consequences would be, and spelled out what those consequences were. That is one I've heard it said. And perhaps that's what held him back. I'm not quite sure. But he did not use those weapons during the Gulf War, you're right.
So, Jack Beatty, now Washington is drawing the line in the sand again with Saddam Hussein. They're saying, let UN inspectors in, or there will be consequences, grave consequences, as yet not spelled out. This is getting to be a formula that could lead us into conflict whether we like it or not. Where do you see this heading?
Well, I thought that Patrick Claussen ticked off the possibilities. This could be a way, I think, as you said, too, of firming up the Security Council to decide on these new sanctions. It could also be a way of signaling Saddam to repent and try something else. But it could also be the first shot across the bow of the American public, reminding us that the war on terror isn't finished so long as Saddam is there. The president significantly changed his war aims when he said that he added to, if they fund a terrorist, they're a terrorist. If they house terrorists, they're terrorists. Mm-hmm. And then he wanted to say, if they develop weapons of mass destruction that will be used to terrorize nations, they will be held accountable. That's a new criteria.
A little something just for Baghdad.
Terror. Yes, right.
Mm. I must say I read it that way, too, in the latter sense. That is, we are entering a new ballgame. That's the way I read the signals.
Kanan Makia, Jack Beatty, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about Iraq. The gun sights of the war on terrorism seem to be slowly turning toward Baghdad. Are you ready for this? Are you ready to see the war on terror extended to Iraq? Is it time to go back after Saddam Hussein? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or you can get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. From President George Bush to Condoleezza Rice to even Secretary of State Colin Powell, the language is being ratcheted up. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Iraq and the way the war on terrorism seems inexorably moving to face Baghdad. Do you want to see the U.S. military rolling into Baghdad? Is this taking the war on terror too far? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. You can join the conversation. We're talking this evening with Professor Kanan Makia. He's a professor of Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. His new book is The Rock, A Tale of 7th Century Jerusalem. And our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Kanan Makia, you've written recently in the New York Times op-ed page that the United States should step up and help Iraqis take their country back. That seems to suggest a different path than sending in the U.S. military. What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that the way to bring about change in Iraq, and what we're talking about here is, let's face it, a new U.S. policy that is directed at regime change in Iraq. Mm-hmm. That the way to do that is not bombing. Iraq has been bombed enough. Iraq has been bombed for 10 years now. And bombing this time in these particular circumstances will be counterproductive. It'll be counterproductive for the region, for the way in which it will be perceived by other Arabs, and by the way in which it will be perceived by Iraqis. In fact, bombing will act to cement Iraqis instead of win them over to the opposition.
So what's the option?
The option is to engineer change working with Iraqis. I would suggest from the north of the country, that is the safe haven that the Kurds now control, and areas and positions in the south that probably would hopefully be facilitated for the Iraqi opposition through Kuwait or even Jordan. These possibilities exist. Certainly the northern one was exploited and was experimented with, and there's a lot of evidence from the experience of the Iraqi opposition up to 1996 when it was essentially rooted out of the north because it wasn't supported by the United States. Experience of that opposition, that units of the Iraqi army can be won over easily, won over because they want to defect, won over, bribed over with relatively little sums, all kinds, and not only basing radio stations in there and slowly pressuring, but sending in teams of people from northern Iraq into Baghdad. This has already been done. It's still being done by elements of the Iraqi opposition. Iraq is a permeable country. It's not the country it was before the last Gulf War. Let's not forget that. It's a country in economic and social collapse. True that in the state of that collapse, the regime sits as a kind of fortress Baghdad, consolidated behind certain walls. But those walls have shrunk. They're not the boundaries of Iraq as we knew them in 1991.
But Kanan Makia, who are you suggesting the U.S. ally with or support? Is this the equivalent of the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan? Who's got the standing and who would be acceptable nationwide in Iraq when you talk about opposition forces in the north and south?
Well, the Kurds occupy something like 25% of the Iraqi territory. The Kurds form 20% of the Iraqi population. The Kurds have no intention ever of being ruled from Baghdad again in the old way in which they always were.
But they're hardly likely to be accepted in Baghdad as the new regime or even as liberators, are they?
Arabs have been working with the Kurds for a very long time now. Iraqi National Congress was an umbrella group that included the Kurdish parties and that included nationalist parties, Islamic parties, and so on. It proved itself effective. It had a lot. It had some infighting. It had problems, that's true. But it proved itself effective in 1995-96 when it started armed operations against the Iraqi regime. I think that experience can be built upon. It's also an experience that would help bring about, when we talk about regime change, one must be thinking beyond the objective of actually bringing down the regime to the alternative that's going to replace it. A process of change, say a change engineered over a six-month period, would help cement that opposition. It would help create those kinds of infrastructures or develop the ones that already exist to be receptacles for or vehicles for taking over after the regime falls.
6 months sounds both long and short a time right now. And I want to talk about what happened in 96, which you referred to. But let us understand first, you were born and brought up in Iraq. What are your own political affiliations or associations there that might inform our understanding of your view, Kanan Makia? Are you Kurdish?
I'm a Muslim Arab. I was born and brought up in Baghdad, like three-quarters of the rest of the country. I mean,
okay.
My family comes originally a long time ago from the south. I left to study abroad, and I was in opposition to this regime and could not go back for many years. I ended up writing a book under a pseudonym because that was the only way to write it. That's the book you mentioned, Republic of Fear. Mm-hmm. And when the uprising took place following the Gulf War, like all the rest of Iraq, which rose up in revolt against the tyrant and called upon the Allies to help them, I too went public at that point in time.
You know, an irony here, I have a friend who's spent a lot of time in the Middle East and in Iraq, and he says that the irony is that, in fact, Iraq, in his view, this is an American businessman, very widely traveled, said it's always looked to him like the best candidate in the region for democratic, market-driven, West-friendly reform. But yet, it's been a bitter enemy now for 10 years and more.
I couldn't agree with your friend more. This is a country with the largest middle class in the Arab world, most highly educated, military-industrial complex, comparable, I mean, it's sort of in relative terms of the Middle East, sort of like a Germany and Japan of the region. This is a country that has built its infrastructure, roads, the Ba'ath did all of this, and even through forced literacy campaigns, it has one of the highest rates of literacy in the Middle East. This is a country that, in other words, could be, just like Germany and Japan after World War II, it is a country that can be changed, can be flipped over, so to speak, very easily. The very same forces, that middle class, that military-industrial complex, that intelligentsia, that technical capability, can be turned inside out, so to speak, into its opposite. And let's remember something else. One of the most remarkable things happened in this country during the Gulf War. It's not often realized just how strange a phenomenon it is for the Middle East. A Middle Eastern population that was bombed more intensively than any other country since World War II, I'm talking about 1991, start of the Gulf War, rose. I know Ba'athist officials who stood on rooftops cheering and asked, after John Simpson of the BBC, I recall, he's got it even in his book, why are the Americans not finishing the job? They rose up in support of the alliance that was ranged against their country. This is very, very rare in history.
Even generally, members of Saddam Hussein's own party, the Ba'ath Party.
Yes, even members of his own party rose up and just wanted the job finished. And then they took two-thirds of the governance of the country, which they held for 2 to 3 weeks. Sadly, the United States would not intervene on their behalf, and they were crushed. Far more Iraqis, incidentally, died because of how that war ended than ever died during the war itself.
Kanan Makiya says that the United States ought to get in there and help opposition to Saddam topple him. The Bush administration is talking so tough right now that it looks like they may not wait that long or go through a third party. What do you think? Are you ready to see the war on terrorism extended to Iraq? Is it time to go back after Saddam Hussein? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, sanctions have been around for a decade now, and that doesn't seem to have had much of an effect on Saddam Hussein himself, though the country has felt the effect.
It sure has, and we've been hearing on this program now for weeks that sanctions are one of the main irritants in the bill of complaint that the Muslim world, the Arab world in particular, has with the United States, and especially the effect of the sanctions on Iraqi children. I was just reading an article by a man who'd sifted through the various studies, and at one point in the 90s, the estimate was of over 500,000 children had died traceably to the sanctions, and Madeleine Albright memorably and cold-bloodedly reacted to that figure by saying the price is worth it. But since then, that has been scaled down to a 350,000 figure, but it's interesting, this oil for food program that Patrick Claussen was talking about, this program seems to have actually helped in some places, but Saddam seems to have subverted in others. One study points out that child mortality in the north, where the UN administers this program of which gives food and medicine in return for oil, child mortality declined. But in the south, where Saddam administered it, it has doubled. And, of course, this also is connected to what others see, which is Saddam has been selling medicine and food on the world market. So these sanctions have been cruel, and the United States has taken a lot of and perhaps deserved blame for them. But on the other hand, Saddam has used them, has exploited the cruelty of them, and even intensified them by sort of, it sounds like here, essentially willing the death of his own people.
But now, We seem to be talking about potentially much more radical steps, about really reshaping the government in Baghdad, potentially. It's all just sort of implicit so far, but the gravity of the threats seems steep. Do you want to see the U.S. military rolling into Baghdad, or is this taking the war on terror too far? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you? Thanks
We're
for
well.
Taking my call. My opinion is, that Hussein may really be a bad guy. He probably is. But I think we really have to be very cautious, and we have to question our authority and our permission to go in. I'm not quite sure that we can, I lived through the Vietnam era, and I think we really have to be suspicious of even our own government. So I don't think we ought to give ourselves the stamp of good guys and just, charge on in there. I think we have to be very cautious, have the Senate involved, have the UN involved, maybe even declare war if that's what it takes.
David, are you confident, given the tenor of the war on terrorism right now, that the Bush administration will take those kind of steps?
No, I don't think they will at all. I think they're relying quite a bit on, flag waving and secrecy. And I really, in the bottom line, don't think we are the bad guys, but I think we have to, that we're doing damage to ourselves if we sidestep the formal steps that we need and the formal steps that we usually take in situations like this.
David, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, let me put that one to you. Do you feel something in the rhythm of the war on terrorism that's been mounted by the Bush administration that requires a new front now, that we've got one chapter behind us in Afghanistan, that we somehow keep it rolling so that we're not bogged down in the details?
Yeah, you could see that coming. It seems to have gone faster in Afghanistan than they anticipated, and the end game seems to be close, although who knows whether the—
Could have a long tail.
Yeah, it could indeed. And in that case, they're going to have to find a new face to put on the war on terror if bin Laden is apprehended or killed. And Saddam looks like a likely target. But I must say, Professor McKeough's way of going at it just seems to me so much more astute. Michael Howard, the British military historian, recently said, the analogy is made between the war on terror and the Cold War. And he said, in the Cold War, hot was nuclear, and we kept the Cold War from going hot. Mm-hmm. He said, in the war on terror, hot is a U.S. invasion of Iraq. He said, this would bring about the clash of civilizations that bin Laden has been hoping for. And I think that I'd like to hear the professor's comment on that.
What about that, Kanamakia? Are the stakes too high? Is the risk too high of crossing that line into Iraq militarily right now? Might we spark something bigger than we bargained for?
Maybe all those things, but I want to look at it that way. I don't think it's in the interest of bringing about stability, peace, and a different kind of regime in Iraq, structurally different regime. I don't think the way of doing that, which I think is the desirable and the primary objective, is by sending U.S. troops into Baghdad. I think it is not necessary. This is a regime that is literally loathed. Loathed is almost too polite a way to put it. This is a regime whose human rights abuses exceed anything since World War II, according to various UN reports. This is a regime that has crossed every boundary of behavior in terms of its own citizens, in terms of the outside world, both in relation to Iran and, of course, in the occupation of Kuwait.
So you're saying Iraqis themselves are ready to take their government, their country, back from Saddam Hussein. But take us back to the 1996 example. That did not end well, and the CIA did not seem to be too effective in helping Iraqi dissidents at that time. What happened?
It wasn't effective because it quite frankly, it undermined the effort from the North. The CIA backed two horses at the same time. It left the opposition that was a coalition of different groups made up of Kurds, Arabs, and Shiites, and Muslim groups, and so on, which would have been a dramatically different type of Iraq with a project for a dramatically different Iraq. It had already voted upon a federal structure, for instance, something that would have ensured that the Kurds had a kind of autonomy that they never had in any Iraqi state before.
These were the opponents in the North, but then there was also backing for military officers.
Exactly. Instead of backing that to the support, there was half-hearted support for that. The real support went for a coup change inside Baghdad. This had Saudi approval and Saudi backing, and the United States chose to go with its allies' preferences in this regard, and I think that was a historic mistake.
And the outcome?
The outcome was that the coup was penetrated by Saddam. Nearly 200 officers were executed and killed. And when he moved against the north, the United States lobbed a few missiles onto radar sites way off in the south and let him go into Erbil, enter the safe haven area, and kill 100 to 150 Iraqi oppositionists who were waiting for American air support that never came.
One wonders if we could do better this time. But hold that thought. I want to bring another call in before our next break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. The question is, should the war on terror be extended now to Iraq? Tony's on the line. Welcome, Tony. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't think that we should start another conflict with Iraq now. I think that we really should stay focused on resolving the issue at hand in Afghanistan and just stay focused and be able to solidly claim victory there and then have the world be able to, you know, have the world perception be that we were victorious there. And I don't mean just militarily. I mean that there's a broad-based government there. It's a democratic government that the world sees that we sort of took some action here and it worked and the people there are better off. And then we'll be in a much better position to sort of go on to the next step. But in the state we are right now, we don't know what's going to happen to the Northern Alliance and things like that. And then to be starting another thing and starting another very tenuous problem or situation seems like it's a big risk. And not only that, it's like we may just never be able to have a clear resolution to any of these issues.
Mm-hmm. Tony, thanks for your call. Kanan Makia, Tony points out that there are a million things that we could do, but maybe we shouldn't try and do them all at once. What could we do practically now that would set in motion what you're describing in Iraq?
I wonder, what I don't want to do is approach it as like a switch, an on-off situation, go from one great big thumping exercise to another one. What is needed, clearly, is a new policy, and then a gradual process of bringing that about while the Afghan situation continues to build on. There are lots of steps that can be taken at the level of diplomacy, at the level of intent, at the level of statement of intention. Transparency and clarity, as one of your earlier callers said, that is essential in U.S. policy. There has been no Iraq policy, let's not forget that, for nearly 10 years.
We'll talk about those changes after the break, but let me ask you first, in the 30 seconds we have left, what about the risk? If indeed Saddam Hussein is developing the weapons that Washington alleges, can we afford to stand back?
Can we afford not to after September 11th?
Well, which way is the greater risk, to go in and provoke Iraq or to stand back and let it continue to develop weapons that could be deployed against the U.S.?
I don't think it has those weapons yet. Certainly the inspectors are worried about them. It has certain weapons. It doesn't have means of deploying them. Biological weapons, but it doesn't have means to deploy them. That seems to be the consensus of expert opinion on this yet. So I think the danger is in waiting, as the United States has done for so long.
Well, of course, we know now that deployment can be as simple as the U.S. mail system. We're talking about the war on terror and whether it may next go to Iraq. The Bush administration is starting to give tough signals to Baghdad. What do you think? Are you ready to see the war on terrorism extended to Iraq? Is it time to go back after Saddam Hussein? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. To see how the Arabic satellite TV network Al Jazeera is reporting on yesterday's threat by Iraq to Iraq by President Bush, visit our website at WBUR.org. Click on special coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the war on terrorism and Iraq. Is that the next destination? The Bush administration is turning up the pressure on Baghdad. Are you ready to see the U.S. military rolling into Iraq, or is that taking the war on terrorism too far? Or might there be a better way to put pressure on Saddam Hussein? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. John is calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're well, thanks.
Good. I just want to make the point. I think it's a mistake to go into Baghdad now to try to get Hussein, because we simply don't have the support for that from the Arab world, and I think that's crucial. And I think it's revisionist history, quite frankly, to look back at the Gulf War and say, in effect, well, the United States made a mistake by not going after Saddam Hussein and going into Baghdad at that point, because the fact of the matter is, not a single Arab country who was supporting the Gulf War supported the concept of going after Hussein in Baghdad. And that's why we didn't do it. It wasn't because the Americans lacked resolve or lacked the ability to do it, but Saudi Arabia is a prime example. They had no support for that idea. and their support was crucial because they were, you know, supplying the bases and supplying a lot of the support from the Muslim world. And I think to ignore that fact in this day and age dooms any failure, dooms any attempt to go into Baghdad to failure, quite frankly.
Fair enough, John. Thanks for your comment. Kanan Makia, let us put that to you. What about the Arabs and Saddam, the Middle Eastern region more generally, and Saddam? Help us understand that relationship.
Okay.
It's confusing. Are they with him or are they against him?
Well, see, we should make a distinction here between regimes and populations.
Mm-hmm.
In the Arab world, we're talking about authoritarian, autocratic regimes that I don't think the United States should be resting all its eggs in that particular basket. That has been the main problem with U.S. policy, that it has not reached out to the populations, and instead it has gone along with regimes. It was the 22 million of Iraq, people of Iraq, who were suffering under the aegis of this dictatorship, plus the Kuwaitis who were under occupation, the Gulf Arabs at the time, the populations that asked for U.S. help and support. It is those populations, especially those suffering most directly under Saddam Hussein, that what the United States should be listening to.
But why didn't Arab neighbors want Saddam taken down in 1991? And what would be the response now if the U.S. supported a more vigorous effort for a change of regimes there in Baghdad?
The Arab regimes would very much support a regime change in their own image, in their own ugly image, I might add, as an Arab and as a Muslim myself. But they would not. What they are worried of, what they're terrified of, is a dramatic change that involves a new kind of Iraq coming into existence, moving in a democratic direction, one which is federally structured, not Arab nationalist, pro-Western. That is a different kind of animal. It's a new kind, and that they fear their own the kind of repercussions of that on the region. Iraq is a very important country, would be such as to destabilize them. That is why the majority of the regimes that your caller mentioned, correctly, he's right, did not want that kind of change. But I don't think that's should be a good enough reason for the United States. Let us not forget, and we're talking here about winning over hearts and minds in the Arab world and this whole campaign against terror. What does it mean to win over hearts and minds? It means to change from a policy of relying on these kinds of regimes. Take Saudi Arabia, a regime that is indirectly, 15 of the hijackers come from Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden himself is Saudi. This is a new phenomenon. The Saudi Arabian regime, as more and more evidence comes out, there was a wonderful piece by Cy Hirsch in the New Yorker 3 or 4 weeks ago, pointing out the degrees of complicity that existed in the involvement of the Saudi elite, Saudi ruling class, indirectly in the Behold Bin Laden phenomenon. I don't say in September 11th, but in the phenomenon as a whole.
Yeah.
This surely should make a wake-up call for the United States. This is not the way to go. Why does the United States, why is anti-Americanism so strong on the Arab street? It is those kinds of policies pursued over a very long period of time that have resulted in it. By contrast, look at Latin America. There was a policy of supporting democratic movements, human rights in Latin America in the 1980s, and it worked. Why can't it work in the Arab world is what I'm saying.
Jack Beatty, here we are again with a strange sequence of postures that our allies, Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, wanting Saddam Hussein to stay out of fear that a successor regime might be more democratic and open and make them look bad by comparison.
Yeah, I think we're finding out more and more that one of our enemies in the war on terror are the domestic arrangements of Egypt and Saudi Arabia. It's from there the terrorists came. Bin Laden will be caught eventually, but the thing that produced Bin Ladenism is present in both those countries: political oppression, the forcing of Islamic opposition figures into extremism, and, you know, the handwriting is on the wall probably for those regimes. They have only looked to Algeria to see what can happen if they keep this up. But what's terrible is we are subsidizing this. And I think Professor McKeer is absolutely right. We have to wake up to what the true dynamics are in the Middle East as regard the relations we have with regimes versus the people of the region.
Kanan Makia, the sanctions are on the table this week, and also inspections for weapons development. Of course, UN inspectors were pulled out, what, 2 or 3 years ago now. Do you think there's any real chance that Saddam Hussein would actually let inspectors back in and truly give them free access to Iraq's military facilities?
I don't, and if he does, it will be the same old dance that we had for 10 years. In other words, producing no results with a lot of frustration and going nowhere.
So doesn't that almost guarantee some military response by Washington? If indeed these new dots are being connected and they're saying if Saddam is close to having these weapons, and he can hand them off to third-party terrorists. This is not an acceptable situation any longer for the U.S. after September 11th. Doesn't that mean we're going in somehow?
That's how I read the signals. I think that the administration knows what certainly the Clinton administration realizes and decided upon after a long time of trying to get the inspections back again, that it was not possible to do so. And I think this administration knows that. It starts from that point of departure. I don't think it's really and genuinely trying to get inspectors back. I wish, frankly, it would have a more transparent policy. It would say what its aims are. That would play far better in the Arab world than to sort of talk about once again inspect. That is to look like the focus is on things, on weapons of mass destruction, which is very important, but I mean not people. I want the U.S. administration to formulate a policy that is orientated to what the people are suffering in that part of the world. It is the wiser course. The weapons of mass destruction will be eliminated in the course of such a policy. But to play that dance, and if you recall the scenes and the various sort of stages that we all went through the 90s on the question of weapons instructions,
mm-hmm.
it is to even imagine replaying that again. Now we will be entering the second decade after the Gulf War is not serious. I mean, the result of those 10 years was that the man is absolutely insistent on acquiring those weapons. He's going to try every possible trick up his sleeve to deceive the inspectors. And to even think that it's a reasonable way of pressuring him now is to look silly in the region and not be taken seriously.
But can the more political approaches or buying off the military and supporting opponents in the North and South work in a time frame that can give comfort to the security concerns of the United States?
I think so. I mean, it's, you know, if he has the weapons, certainly. I mean, we're not talking about many, many years. This is a brittle regime. The moment it looks like its own soldiery is deserting, the U.S. is absolutely solid on its assurances to the opposition. It is not going to let him walk into cities like Erbil again. The moment these things become transparently clear, the rats will start jumping off the ship. And if they are absorbed, if the army is absorbed, units of the army, people who want to desert are given a way and a place and a room to desert to, and assurances, may I add, amnesties and so on, which need to be formulated and were formulated by the opposition before and distributed inside Iraq. These are the kinds of political steps that need to be taken to undermine the regime from within. It can be done in Iraq.
Mm. Kanan Makia, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Kanan Makia is professor of Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. He is author of Republic of Fear, The Politics of Modern Iraq, and his new book, The Rock, A Tale of 7th Century Jerusalem. Jack Beatty, we're hearing a vision here of more change in the works and potentially more quickly than anyone would expect. Kanan Makia is saying it's so brittle in Baghdad, it could fall apart without U.S. troops even going in.
Yeah, we're just seeing in Afghanistan how an oppressive regime, when once a little force is applied, can begin to crack. I mean, 3 weeks ago, a month ago, the Taliban ruled the whole country. Now they don't. However, it took an opposition on the ground and bombing. Now, whether some combination of those, whether the bombing would neutralize the good effect of the politics, I don't know. But the model of Afghanistan is U.S. air power plus forces on the ground. I take his point, though. I mean, the political dynamics are there. Why tip them into anti-Americanism? Mm-hmm. They're already tipped against Saddam. Let's use the dynamics that are there.
In fairness, we don't know that the Bush administration is not planning on a path that might, in fact, take advantage of that.
Yes, and that would be very astute indeed, coupled with a change in the sanctions such that they would be more clearly beneficial to people. In fact, that's what the new sanctions regime would be like. It would prescribe military or dual-use imports while allowing almost a free flow of civilian goods. That would be all to the good to say to the Arab street, look, we are doing something on these sanctions. We are going to try to mitigate the cruelty of them.
There's a feeling of steel and military menace in the words out of Washington, but George Bush does say, we're not saying what Saddam Hussein will face, simply that he'll find out.
Yeah, yeah.
Jack, stay with us for a moment. We're going to switch and look at something else that's happened very interestingly in the U.S. in the last week. Just hang on for a second. We're going to play something very interesting for all of our listeners. Nationwide, the U.S. Department of Justice is looking to interview about 5,000 men from Arab countries who are living in the United States on temporary visas. This week in Michigan, several hundred young Middle Eastern men will be finding a letter from the Detroit office of the United States Attorney in their mailboxes. The letter asks the men to phone the office as soon as possible to make an appointment to speak with the U.S. attorney and answer questions related to the attacks on September 11th. Here's the letter as read by WBUR's Kevin Brooks.
November 26, 2001. Dear Sir, as you know, law enforcement officers and federal agents have been acquiring information that may be helpful in determining the persons responsible for the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Furthermore, they are pursuing all leads that may assist in preventing any further attacks. I am asking that you assist us in this important investigation. Your name was brought to our attention because, among other things, you came to Michigan on a visa from a country where there are groups that support, advocate, or finance international terrorism. We have no reason to believe that you are in any way associated with terrorist activities. Nevertheless, you may know something that could be helpful in our efforts. In fact, it is quite possible that you have information that may seem irrelevant to you, but which may help us piece together this puzzle. Please contact my office to set up an interview at a location, date, and time that is convenient for you. During this interview, you will be asked questions that could reasonably assist in the efforts to learn about those who support, commit, or associate with persons who commit terrorism. While this interview is voluntary, it is crucial that the investigation be broad-based and thorough. And the interview is important to achieve that goal. We need to hear from you as soon as possible, by December 4. Please call my office between 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. any day, including Saturday and Sunday. We will work with you to accommodate your schedule. Yours truly, Jeffrey Collins, United States Attorney, Robert P. Cares, Assistant United States Attorney.
That was a letter sent to about 700 Middle Eastern men living in Michigan by the U.S. Attorney in Detroit, as read by WBUR's Kelvin Brooks. Jack Beatty, put yourself in the shoes of a Middle Eastern man living in Detroit or elsewhere in Michigan. How do you feel when that letter arrives in your mailbox?
Well, it must be a chilling experience. They're being asked possibly to name names. One of the questions is say you should ask whether the individual is aware of any person who has sympathy for the September 11 hijackers or other terrorists. They're going to be asked about their political beliefs. This is I don't know. I find it troubling, and I don't see how it could actually be effectual. I mean, is it really likely that in a Q&A, someone who was involved even peripherally in September 11th would give the game away? This seems most unlikely to me.
On the other hand, we're told that mosques themselves in some areas may have been planning areas for this. You know, is this just turning over every stone to find the trail of a really lethal threat?
I don't know. It just does sound like something that's pushing our tradition of law as far as it can go, as does President Bush's other departure, which is that we're going to try people. Say if any of these people are accused of terrorism, he can say, you are a suspected terrorist, and try them here or on a ship someplace in a military court. This, too, is a dramatic departure from our legal tradition. Hmm.